Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Stephanie Kuntz, who has been a guest on the show many times. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council for Contemporary Families, teaches History and Family Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, has been on the show for, I think, actually all of her previous books, The Way We Never Were, American Families, and The Nostalgia Trap, Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage, The Way We Really Are, Coming to Terms with America's Changing Families, and her other books as well, and is probably America's leading thinker on families, and really an interesting new thinker on families in the way she looks at it. Her latest book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. And Stephanie Kuntz, welcome. It's good to have you with us once again.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back, Mark.
So, Betty Friedan, I think it'd be interesting for you to, since in many ways, as I read the book, you didn't necessarily love the book. You thought you had read the book and were asked to write about the book. Tell that story first.
Well, it's embarrassing, but when my editor at Basic Books called me up and said, we're doing a series of biographies, not of individuals, but of books, and how would you like to do one on the feminine mystique? And I said, oh, that would be wonderful. I totally had it in my head that I'd read this book, partly because my mother used to call me about it when I was away at college and tell me, I mean, here, you know, I'm a 19-year-old rolling my eyes, but she would call me up and say, oh, here's what this book says, here's what this book says. And I was more interested in the civil rights movement at that time and really didn't think about whether women needed any rights. You know, we'd won the vote. What more did we need? But made, later, as I got into realizing that there were still a lot of rights to be won, I read excerpts or people would tell me about the feminine mystique. And you know how many people who haven't read the Bible think they know everything that it reads?
Well, right.
You know, that's what happened to me with the feminine mystique. So I sat down to read this book, and I went, oh, my gosh, I've never read it before. The first few paragraphs are amazingly stirring, but after that, it just seems so mealy-mouthed and uncontroversial. Some of the things she says are so wrong. A total shock. And I'd already assigned it to my students. I was going, oh, my goodness.
How did they react to it?
Well, they reacted the same way, but both of us went through the same changes, that as we reread it in conjunction with the history, and particularly when we got to the chapter on the sexual cell, we began to more appreciate what that book had done for a layer of women who simply had never heard of these things before and was beating up on themselves for all that they were feeling.
It's interesting that, I mean, I think many people today know the phrase feminine mystique. The name Betty Friedan is that doesn't just drop off everyone's lips, but it's a known name. People remember it. Many even know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think it'd be important here for a moment to say who she is, because it's and what this book seemed to have meant to many, the myth and the reality of it both.
Right.
And because I think there are a lot of folks who have never read it who just hear that word.
That's right. And there are a lot of myths that surround both Betty Friedan and the book. I mean, Betty Friedan herself contributed to some of the myths about herself, and why don't we come back to that? But let me start with the book. The feminine mystique, today, as you say, the phrase is bandied about. People think they know what it means. When I get Google alerts on it, some of them say, oh, embrace the feminine mystique, buy this perfume, and others talk about this horrible book. The right-wing magazine Human Events lists it seventh in its list of the most harmful books ever of the 19th and 20th century, only a couple points below Mein Kampf. And then there are other people who say, oh my gosh, it started the woman's movement. And I know when I was interviewing people, I ended up interviewing 188 women and men who had read the book at the time. But actually, I could have interviewed about 300 people in terms of the ones who wrote to me and told me they'd read the book, and they had the same problem I had. They were remembering something that they had never read. So some of them told me, oh, this is the book that told people to burn their bras.
Right.
Or some of them said, oh, this is the one that that documented all the discrimination facing women. Actually, not at all. Betty Friedan's message was stunningly simple. And uncontroversial in today's terms. She said, women are people too, not just wives and mothers. It's okay to want something not even other than, but in addition to being a wife and mother. And you have been told by sociologists, by psychiatrists, by the mass media, that you should find all of your happiness in mopping the kitchen floor, preparing the best roast beef ever, and in looking in finding your identity to your husband's and son's achievements. And she was right. She documented. I mean, psychiatrist Helene Deutsch, a very, very famous psychiatrist, actually said the normal woman today renounces all individual aspirations, not out of coercion as in the bad old days when women couldn't vote, but because the normal woman finds no higher satisfaction than in living through her husband's and her son's achievements. And of course, when women didn't find that, they thought there was something wrong with that. In fact, there was an interesting Gallup poll taken a month before Friedan's book appeared, in which actually women said, supposedly at first glance, that this is in fact all the happiness that they could get, that they were the happiest people on world precisely because they knew, unlike men, they knew exactly why they were put on earth, to take care of their husband and children. But it's very interesting because when you explore that sort of reflexive, oh, yes, I'm happy, we've got things ever better, you find two real problems underneath it. First of all, even in that direct poll, 90% of the women said, I don't want my daughter to do what I did.
Right,
I want
right.
her to get more of an education. I want her to get more of a job. I don't want her to marry so quickly. And as soon as you actually look at the interviews behind the immediate response, are you happy? Sociologists, we have a lot of these from the 50s. And people would tell to the surveyors, yes, I'm happy. And then they would go on to describe instances of abuse, contempt, drinking problems. And they would just treat them as little glitches because the marital advice of the era is that anything that goes wrong in your marriage is definitely your fault. If your husband is unfaithful, it's because you're not well-groomed enough. If he hits you, it's because you're acting too, quote, efficient and masculine. So women had no sense of entitlement to any of the things that we would think a woman should be able to expect from marriage or life.
You've written so much here, and I've underlined a bunch, and I want to kind of go through some of this because I think that I wanted your words to come out to get people to kind of realize what this book meant and what period we were in. That one of the things you said early in the book, Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, in many ways was wrapped in the language of the human potential movement. It's like a self-help book. It was like liberating women from the outside to get outside of their marriages and their worlds. And you talk about the titles of the chapters, and I went and bought another copy because I couldn't find my copy of Feminine Mystique, and they really are amazing titles. As you wrote, The Sexual Solipsism of Sigmund Freud, The Functional Freeze, The Feminine Protest, and Margaret Mead, and I think as you wrote, the most underlined chapter in the book, Sexual Cell, that this kind of thing grabbed the consciousness and frustrations of women just by the titles alone.
Well, it's interesting, Mark, because these are not the kind of titles you find in modern self-help books. You know, they sound way off-putting. I mean, any editor today would say, oh my gosh, nobody will buy a book that has a chapter title like the Sexual Solipsism. They won't even know what that word means. So it's interesting because the book worked at two levels. On the first hand, its writing was very simple, very plain. It starts, I take the title of my book from the first paragraph in where she says, every day across America, housewives, as they make the peanut butter sandwiches for their kids, they chauffeur them to Cub Scouts, they select new slip covers, and at night they lie beside their husband, and they feel this strange stirring, this yearning, and they're afraid to even ask themselves, is this all there is? And they blame themselves for not being content. And so she talked very much in the language of self-help people, and her message was very simple. You are not alone. There are many other people who feel this. And you have a right to feel this because you're a human being, too. Your meaning and your identity ought to be just more than just taking care of your husband and kids. But at the same time, unlike most self-help books since then, she provided people with the ammunition, the practical data and the intellectual ammunition they needed to counteract what they were telling about, what they'd been told about what a normal woman should feel and why it was abnormal for them to feel anything different. One woman I interviewed, she was actually atypical because she had already decided not to duplicate her mother's life, and yet all of these messages were coming down to her, and she said, I carried that book around me like a shield of armor. You know, I could quote it to people when they told me that, no, this is abnormal for you to want to finish college instead of getting your Mrs. degree, your MRS degree.
It was an amazing time. I mean, I think that when you write in here that a one housewife told you, who had four children, you have freed me from such a mass of subconscious and conscious guilt feelings that I feel today as though I've been filled with helium and turned loose. And then you talk about a younger woman who's 19 years old who wrote, I was so enthralled, my heart beating only for the next word, next fact, next idea. I had to stop and do something to express my fervor. I splashed out a big sign, Yay, Betty Friedan, to tape on the wall in front of me.
Yes, that one came from a letter that Friedan herself actually received. But the people, when I interviewed these women, and remember, it's almost 50 years after they read the book, they could often remember what they were doing, where they were sitting when they read the book. One woman was sitting under the hairdryer at a beauty salon. The reaction, there's this woman, Constance Ahrens, who is a well-known sociologist who used to just intimidate. When I first met her, she just intimidated me so bad because she was so smart, and I could, you know, I've heard her eviscerate people for their bad research. I couldn't believe it. When I talked to her about reading that book, she was 19 years old. She'd been sent to college to get her MRS degree. Her parents were very clear, that's what you go to college for. She'd gotten it, dropped out of college, was pregnant, got pregnant at 19, had moved into the middle class by doing exactly what was considered to be the best route to the middle class for women in those days. She'd married that man with a college degree, and he took advantage of all of the openings of the post-war economy, and he'd moved her into this wonderful suburb where she had time to play bridge and get her hair done every week, and she was miserable. Just miserable. And she said, I felt so guilty for being miserable. I thought to myself, you're so selfish, you're going to be punished. And she said that when she read that book, she started crying halfway through the first chapter, and halfway through the book, she'd gone to a psychiatrist because she thought she was so messed up. She flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet. So it just had a stunning impact on women.
And it was a time, as you wrote about, where we had the whole notion of the housewife syndrome. And this Freudian world that kind of had taken over the thinking of America and the world in terms of human behavior and sexual behavior and women's roles and penis envy. And it was Friedan, in some ways, for this set of women who actually took that on.
Yes, you know, there were plenty of people who were criticizing it. But it was very hard to get past this into the public media, you know. I mean, I went through a lot of magazines of the era. And interestingly enough, it was especially the magazines aimed at middle-class women with a little more education than normal who really emphasized this, the idea that this was a woman's role, that men and women were so different, that men were defined as sexually aggressive, competitive, ambitious, women as dependent, passive. Even a normal woman was slightly masochistic, they felt. And so the more you read in those days as a woman, the more you knew this was the way you were supposed to be, and you were sexually abnormal if you weren't that way. So these women were just tremendously miserable. And, you know, Mark, one of the myths that I keep running across when I talk about the 60s, a lot of people realize that career women were disliked in the 60s. And, in fact, we should spend a little time talking about what it was like for working women. But a lot of people think that homemakers had higher social status. No, they didn't. They were told that it should be their their greatest happiness in life. But they were also told that they shouldn't. You should get all your satisfaction from being a wife and mother, but you shouldn't let your husband or your son know that you're getting all your satisfaction from that. Because too many women, in fact, it was called the disease of momism, are smothering their sons by being overprotective about them. They're nagging their husbands into an early grave by getting them to fulfill all their ambitions. So you get all these mixed messages. And by the way, the same people who were telling women to get all their satisfactions of being a wife and mother were also saying, once your kids are growing, stop being a parasite. Go out and get a job. Only make sure it's a job that doesn't earn enough to threaten your husband or interest you enough to threaten your interest in your husband and your grown children. So these women really felt like they were going mad, and with good reason they were being driven mad. They also had almost no rights. In 1963, I found that only 8 states gave a wife any legal claim at all, a homemaker, to her husband's earnings or property. It wasn't until the 1980s that a woman who had put her husband through med school or law school had any right to any of the earnings she had enabled by doing so.
That's amazing. And you write in the book, later in the book, that about the battle over the, after Betty Friedan helped create the National Organization of Women in the battle for the Civil Rights Bill, that even some of the Southern senators and congressmen were trying to use the issue of women's rights to drive a wedge.
Yes, this was, sort of one of the ironies of history, you know, blowback, I think we call it,
right.
They supported the Taliban and then they turned against us. Well, there was certainly blowback on this as well. Because what happened with the Civil Rights Bill is that came in 1964. It began in 63 and wasn't ratified. And many of the Southerners who opposed it were looking for ways to derail this because it had a lot of momentum in those days. So some of the feminists, and there were plenty of feminists in government before Betty Friedan came along, were saying, well, if we're going to prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, we should also prohibit it on the basis of gender. So one particular prominent Southern guy said, okay, I'm going to introduce this as an amendment. And he was not serious. What he calculated was that this would offend so many people in the climate of the days that even people who had been willing to vote for ending discrimination against blacks would certainly not vote for it against ending discrimination against women. And to his surprise, it did actually go through despite this. So here you are with this kind of fluke. And when the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission was formed, they initially refused to make any effort on behalf of women, so that although they did outlaw segregated job want ads in the newspapers for blacks and whites, they refused to do it for males and females. The New York Times, until 1968, had Help Wanted Female, which was mostly for Gal Fridays, pretty cheerful receptionists. One employer stipulated you must be really beautiful.
That's right, right.
Sometimes they asked for college grads, but only if they had good typing skills. And, of course, these women were paid less, could be fired at a moment's notice, and then there were the male Help Wanted ads. So it's really stunning to look back and see. We talk about those 60s as a liberated era and a liberating era, but actually the discrimination against women didn't begin to get ended until the 70s.
And this is also, you point out a lot of things in this book, some contradictions. And you've mentioned now several times when I've raised something that other people have written about this, other people have talked about this before Friedan, around Friedan's time, when she first wrote the book, because we give, I think that you make a really strong case here that, A, we give too much credit to Friedan. People think she started the women's movement. That you seem to be also took some angst at you know, her not giving credit to other women who came before her, Simone de Beauvoir and many others, who wrote of similar things. So that, I think you've made that point like 3 times. Talk a bit about that.
Well, Friedan, I went through this actually tremendous emotional evolution in my work on this book because, first of all, I found out I didn't read it, and then I felt kind of stupid about myself. then when I did read it, you know, there are all these things in it that are very bothersome to a modern reader. She accepts some of the Freudian strictures that overprotecting mothers turn their sons into homosexuals, which we now know is not true. She turned it on its head to say, well, in that case, why don't we give women some interest other than just protecting their... But it was still, you know, a kind of repellent thing to read. Plus, she was trying so hard to reach out to women's magazine readers that she tended to misrepresent her debts to other people and downplay them. She wanted to say, I'm just one of you. She didn't tell them that she'd been a star psychology student in college or that she used to work for union organizing for women and that she herself was involved in the civil rights struggle to integrate the housing the housing neighborhood in which she lived. She just wanted to relate to these readers of women's magazines, slightly more educated than normal, housewives, many of them, people who had chosen housewifery over other options that they had, and who had things much better than their mothers and grandmothers and were therefore feeling guilty. But when I first read the book, I was kind of angry at Friedan for misrepresenting this, for ignoring the problems of black women and working class women. I still think that this is, you know, a terrible weakness in the book, particularly because African-American women, you know, a lot of people think, oh, what the problem is, most black women would have loved to be homemakers with these kinds of problems. In fact, the opposite is true. Black women had a long history of not feeling guilty when they had to work outside the home or were community activists. It was black leaders of males and females who both suggested that women should have a tripartite identity as wives and mothers, as co-breadwinners, and as community activists. So I think it's very sad that she didn't talk about this in her book. On the other hand, by the end of the book, after talking to the 188 women and a few men who read her at the time, hearing their hair-raising stories about the treatment they went through and how completely demoralized they were, how much they turned this in on themselves, I began to realize that you don't have to build a moral hierarchy of who hurts worse. These women were feeling real pain. It wasn't trivial pain. It wasn't boredom. They knew that they had privileges. One woman told me, my gosh, there were kids, black kids getting beaten up down south, Appalachian kids with bellies swollen from malnutrition. What right did I have to feel so unhappy? So their pain, they knew that their pain was the other side of certain kinds of privileges. That just made them feel all the more guilty. And so I began to say, okay, Friedan has real limits. She didn't invent the women's movement. She didn't talk to all women. But she did a huge service for this one group of women. And actually at that point, my book turned into a biography not of the feminine mystique, and it had never been one of Betty Friedan, but a biography of a group of women that we have forgotten today. I began to think of them as the sidelined wives and oldest daughters of the greatest generation. And when most people talk about the greatest generation, they're really talking about the guys. These women would never have called themselves the greatest.
Right.
They felt like the lowliest. And I have come to appreciate so much the pain they went through and the courage it took when they did begin to say, I can be something else.
And I think that is kind of the what you raise in this book, and after the break we'll come back to this, when you raise in this book the contradictions of that time, how the mass media separated society into the imagery of society became completely white with the rise of television. It was already there, but I mean really white with the rise of TV, and how this growth of the 50s, the middle class, and you say that the greatest generation and women stuck in this world, but the contradictions of race, class, and you raise all that, and you kind of take this discussion to an interesting height where you kind of can intersect the role of the women's movement, mostly middle class and white, all at the same time the civil rights movement was going on, and that the black middle class world had its own story that no one ever told, and how that all intersected. And I think that's one of the powers of this book, to me anyway. So before we get to that, we're going to take a very brief break and come right back. talking to Stephanie Kuntz, who I consider the leading thinker in our country on families and the complexities our family has grown and the idea of that over history. Her latest book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Stephanie Kuntz. Her latest book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. One of the things I think that there's a piece in here. Let me pull this out. Because you mentioned black and white perceptions. And to me, there are some really, really, really interesting pieces that you pull out of this book. Later on in your book, let me just kind of throw some of this stuff out, and then we can talk about what this means to you and what the analysis of all this is. That in the African-American world, you wrote that college-educated African-American women in the early 1960s and in the 1950s who expected to marry a man with equal education like her less educated sisters to work after marriage. Black women in college were more likely than the white counterparts to feel there was no contradiction between their professional roles of being trained in college and future roles they would assume as wives. But in the study of 5,000 white college women in the 1950s, fewer than 40% reported they were attending college to train for future careers. But black female college students, by contrast, in a 1956 study of those women, found that 90% of those women are going to college to prepare for a vocation. These were very different worlds.
Yes, yes. And it wasn't just because of financial necessity. Now, I don't want to downplay financial necessity. This was a period when female college grads of both sexes and male college grads who were black earned less than the average white male high school grad. So certainly these people, these college women had to anticipate that maybe even with two incomes they might need her to work. But it was much more than that, because the African-American college women talked also about the need to be educated to play a larger role in your community. And they did, and although they worried, the African-American community was no feminist paradise, although they worried about whether their husbands would accept their equality and accept, them as real equals, they were also not prepared, as so many of the white women were, to play dumb on dates, to pretend that they weren't interested in anything else. And sociologist Bart Landry did some really interesting research, and he found that although middle-class white women were already entering the workforce, among white women, the upper-middle-class wives and mothers were the least likely to work outside the home. But among black women, the upper-middle-class wives and mothers, the ones whose husbands were most able to support them outside the home, were the most likely to work. And he also found another very interesting thing, that if your husband disapproved of your working, like 90% of the white wives didn't work. But that was true of only about half of the black wives. So you have this tradition of independence in the black community that was really sad that Friedan wasn't able to draw upon and point out to people.
You know, while sexism is alive and well in every culture in America, one of the things here, I think this is really interesting exploration in this chapter. You have a quote, not a quote, but that you paraphrase E. Franklin Frazier, the great sociologist, who had particular praise, as it was written, the self-assertion of black women and the egalitarian nature of modern African-American marriages, and that 60% of black middle-class families were two-earner families. And I even my own growing up, it made me think of all the black families in the 50s and 60s that I knew, and that almost every mother worked, school teacher, social worker, lawyer. And the husbands worked, school teacher, social worker, lawyer, doctor. But I never thought about it until this book made me start thinking about the kind of real difference of what that means, and also the whole question of the power of those marriages and why they wouldn't have bought into the feminine mystique that Betty Friedan wrote, and she actually didn't write for them at all.
Well, we got two – I would make one little caveat
Go ahead, please.
And that is that – E. Franklin Frazier went back and forth on that. On the one hand, he was influenced by the dominant psychiatry today. So in some articles, he would worry about, you know, whether the black women were matriarchs or not, just as Daniel Moynihan later got worried. But on the whole, there was much more acceptance of this in of women's working and of women's community roles in the black community, even though they were not, you know, considered completely equal. There was still sexism in the black community. The other thing I would want to add to this, it's absolutely true. Black women have always worked and have had the expectation that they would be independent. You know, I actually interviewed some African-American women who in the 90s quit work to raise their kids, and their own mothers would say to them the opposite of what happened to white women who went to work. They would say, their black mothers would say, I didn't raise you to be dependent on a man. The other little caveat I want to put here is that there were many black women, of course, who couldn't get jobs as social workers and teachers and who worked as domestics in other people's homes. And they didn't necessarily want to quit their jobs, but they sure wanted to improve their jobs.
Right.
And in fact, when the National Organization for Women formed in 1966, that was one of the first things they undertook, was to open new jobs for black women. But one of the sad things about Betty Friedan's book is that at a certain point in the book, she starts talking about how, yes, it's good for you to go out and get jobs, and after all, you can hire someone else to be a nanny or a child care worker. So it's no wonder that a lot of black women didn't relate to this book, and I think that's a sad little piece of it. I don't think it discredits what she did, for whom she did, and what she did as an individual, which turned out to be very good for working class women and black women as well. But this was a real blind spot in the book and explains why so few black women actually finished it.
No, I understand that. I want to come back to the whole thing of the issues of what Betty Friedan's, the conversations that she engendered did in general for this society and for women in general. But I began to think as I was thinking about this book this morning, and these chapters about black and white women and working class women and upper middle class women, that from the very beginning of the women's movement and now to the place we are today in 2011, that in some ways these were the seeds of the dislocation sometimes between black and white women and their views about feminism and what we call women's liberation and women's role in society. You know, there's always these people, there's always these loggerheads that are going on, and this is raised often in a lot of circles. And I could see some of the roots of that in what you wrote.
Yes. Although, in fact, as I try to show in the book, black women were, in fact, more supportive than white women at the time of the need for women to become community organizers and to contribute to the family, and more demanding of respect at home. And today, African-American husbands actually do more housework than white husbands do on average, which is not to say, as I say, that there wasn't sexism. Even Rosa Parks' own lawyer told her that he thought women's place was in the kitchen.
Right.
Rather than in the front of the bus.
I read that. Yes. Going back to what Betty Friedan and this book, this whole concept of feministic did, I was really enthralled by many of the pieces that you pulled out from all the interviews you did with all these women who had read the book and were reflecting now back on that period. Things like one woman who wrote, I had a feeling at 25 that my life was over and that nothing interesting would ever happen to me again. I told myself the fix I was in was my own fault. There was something wrong with me. I had everything a woman was supposed to want, marriage to a nice, dependable guy, a good provider, a wonderful little kid, a nice house in the suburbs, and I was miserable. Someone else wrote, I don't know why I was so unhappy until I read The Feminine Mystique. Then something clicked, like light bulbs going off again and again. What a sense of relief, knowing that I'm not alone. It's not just me. And finally, I got my mind back, one woman told you. My depression fell off in layers month after month after I took her advice, went back to work, but went back to the work with the way I'd always wanted to but never quite dared. I mean, this book really did have a profound effect on many of the women who read it and kind of embraced it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I mean, I started with the myth in my head that it had had an impact on all women, and that there was no real strong feminist movement before. And that's not true. There were feminists who had been working quietly in government, trying to get President Kennedy. They'd finally talked him into, you know, starting a president's commission on the status of women, and those findings were kind of eye-opening. There were plenty of women working, and then there were plenty of women who came into the movement in the late 60s and early 70s who had never read The Feminine Mystique, who had been brought to a consciousness of women's position either by going out into the workforce and just finding how deep the discrimination was, or by working in the civil rights movement or the peace movement or the New Left and learning just how, you know, sexist some of the guys in that were, you know, mm-hmm. make the coffee.
Yes. I remember it well.
So as I say, when I first started, that was kind of a shock. But then when I realized there was this wide layer of women who were just miserable and had no access to the kinds of information or experiences that would teach them, as these people kept telling me, that these problems were not their fault. They were a natural reaction to being denied a piece of their humanity.
You know, what you just said made me think how deep it really was in that period. I remember two instances. One in 1966 at a Students for Democratic Society, an SDS convention, I believe it was in Ann Arbor, if I remember correctly, where women got up, Kathy Wilkerson and a bunch of other women got up, and talked about the rights of women, women's liberation of not just running the office, of being in the forefront, being officers in the struggle, blah, 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 and all the rest. And I remember men across the room, an auditorium full of young radicals, shouting them down, screaming at them, and some of the African-American men in the room doing the same. And I remember the look on the women's faces when they saw the black men doing the same thing as the white men, how shocked they were. But I'll never forget that day, because it was a pivotal moment, and it describes the intensity, I think, of the feeling of the moment and the milieu that we lived in the 50s and 60s when it came to men and women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I wasn't at that meeting, but I've heard accounts of it, including from some guys who later felt guilty about it. And the things they were shouting at those women are things we cannot say on the radio.
Exactly. No, exactly. You couldn't. I remember it really well. I remember Heather Booth and all these other women that were up there who you mentioned in your book. So the sense of the fear of women coming into their own was really part of the mystique of the moment that was being broken.
That's right. And it crossed all political boundaries. You know, the people, the organization types that you see portrayed in Mad Men were contemptuous of women, but so were the beatniks and the New Left.
Yes,
and it
right.
was just huge.
So, you know, when looking at this, one of the things you also make clear in this book is that, and we've touched on a little bit, is that a lot was going on in that period, and women were standing up on their own. Talk a bit about the difference between whether the notion that Betty Friedan kind of started this women's movement. The reality was she was part of a social movement and moment, and her book kind of caught America's eye, but a lot was going on around her in 1960, 61, 62, 63, that this book was part of. It just seemed to explode on the scene at that time.
Yes, there were women working behind in government trying to increase the representation of women. There were labor union women who were organizing for rights. The flight attendants were saying, you know, you got to stop firing us when we turn 30, or firing us when we get married or pregnant, or put on a few pounds. And I remember one particular hearing on that when this one guy, this representative who later became a supporter of women's rights, when they complained about this being asked to weigh in every week, he told the flight attendants humorously, "Oh, stand up so we can see the dimensions of the problem."
Mm.
I mean, can you imagine that happening today?
I can imagine it happening but not being accepted.
No, exactly.
Unfortunately. So when you – I'm curious where you ended up with this in many ways. I mean, because at the end of the book you bring us to today's world and many of the contradictions even men are facing, which we can kind of talk about in a minute. But this was – this idea, this idea of liberating women from upper middle class women and women who worked, lived at home, raising their children, delivering them from what they were labeled as crazy for, I think is really very profound and powerful. I mean, I think about, you talk about your mother. I think about my mother too as I was reading your book. That these women who were brilliant, motivated, who had fought in World War II, many of them, or built planes in World War II, had been alone and did all these things by themselves, and then all of a sudden turned around in this new burgeoning middle-class world of America, found themselves trapped in the worlds they thought they would love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and one of the big myths about Betty Friedan is that she told these women to become careerists or consumerists.
Right.
Friedan would have hated Sex and the City, I think, because she kept saying, look, it is not, you know, you feel this hunger. You're not going to satisfy this hunger by buying more things, by getting a better house, by changing husbands, by having better sex. You're only going to satisfy this hunger by doing something that utilizes your talents, has meaning, and contributes something to the world.
I mean, she did not like Helen Gurley Brown very much, I would imagine.
No, not at all. Although a year earlier, as you say, Helen Gurley Brown had also talked about the need for women to assert themselves in terms of saying, you know, that she did it on a sexual way, that women have sexual needs just as men do, and women are paid unequally. So her solution was use your sexuality both to enjoy yourself and to get the guy to buy you things. And Friedan would very much have opposed that.
So tell me, I'm curious, again, as you pull this together, who are some of the people that you would talk about that were left out by Betty Friedan, that were left out of history, that you think played a pivotal role even though they didn't have a book that sold all these copies?
Well, you go back to Simone de Beauvoir, whose book The Second Sex was very influential in pointing out the social construction of womanhood, that a lot of these prejudices were, you know, actually came from society. They were not women's nature. There was a sociologist named Mira Komorowski who really analyzed a lot of the problems facing middle-class and educated women and then compared them to working-class women and the different sources of pain and anxiety in each of these women's lives. So there were a lot of people writing on this. But the thing is that Friedan managed to pull it together, grab this brilliant title that really captured people's attention, and put it on the table. You mentioned men a couple of minutes ago, and I think this is important, too, because she also didn't talk to men and men's feelings about this very much. Some feminists have blamed her for not asking men to do more housework, but again, the men that I interviewed from the 50s and 60s were really grateful for what their wives learned because it did press them to do more around the house. You know, a really interesting finding in my interviews was that although women felt the sense of crisis, like the quote you read, you know, I've got my good provider, I've got my kid, I've got a new house, now I still feel something missing, guys didn't feel their sense of crisis until it was almost too late when they retired and they went, oh my gosh, I'm stranger to my kids. I've never had a real involvement in family life. So many of the men I talked to felt that the feminine mystique had liberated them as well.
So if you fast forward, as you do in the last part of your book, to where we are now, and you just mentioned men, you write a lot about the place that men find themselves in vis-a-vis the feminine mystique, the mystique of work, the contradictions that are arising from all that now.
No,
go ahead. I found that really fascinating, just about how many men feel overworked and feel like there's this contradiction in lives, not enough time with their kids, not enough time with their families. We'd love to work less, but don't. How much more we work in this country than other people do.
one of the big victories of the feminist movement is that these problems are no longer exclusive to women, and in fact that not all women have them. You know, there's a 5% of top earners in women who really do not face a glass ceiling problem, who actually get a motherhood bonus because they're so valuable to their companies that they get lots of help. They get flexible leave. But the other 95% of women still face a motherhood penalty. But increasingly, women have not only, they've convinced men not only that it's right, but that it's rewarding to participate in family life. And men are still very much treated as though this should not be one of their interests and responsibilities, and they are actually penalized at work. So today, men actually report higher levels of work-family conflict on average than women do. And I think that reflects the fact that they are longing for the same balance, just as women are saying, I need to have an identity that allows me to be both a mother and a worker. Men are saying, I need to have an identity that allows me both to be a worker and a family man. And, of course, our job situation, you know, our job policies, our lack of family leave policies make that difficult. They assume that we're still back in the 50s where every full-time, well-paid employee had a wife to take care of everything else.
So I wonder if you now think about the real place of this notion of feminine mystique has come to in our world today. I mean, here's a book that spoke to tens of thousands of mostly middle and upper class white women in that early period. Civil rights was going on, as you write about, and it was the daughters, you being one of the daughters, and your friends who had a very different view looking at civil rights and where we've come to today with all this. Talk about where you the conclusion you've come to about the power of this feminine mystique and what legacy has left us here in this century.
Well, the feminine mystique, as Betty Friedan described it, really no longer exists. It's very important for us to understand how widespread it was. And I think that one of my hopes is that people can read this book and learn to appreciate their mothers and grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
But the feminine mystique that those mothers and grandmothers face is pretty much gone now. If you talk to young women today, they don't feel that they have to play dumb on dates. They don't feel that they have to fail at sports and let the man win. It's okay for women to aspire to the kind of occupations that used to be completely reserved for men. On the other hand, there's a couple of other feminine mystiques that have crept in that we really have to worry about. One is these young girls feel that they can do it all, but they also feel that they have to be sexually attractive. They have to be hot. They have to be interested in sex, that they have to display their sexuality. I call it the haughty mystique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it can be another different kind of trap for young women. And then there's another feminine mystique that kicks in at motherhood. And that is no longer do they say you cannot be a mother and have a job. You cannot be a wife and have a job. But they say being a mother is so time-consuming. You have to do everything perfect. You have to be able to work basically 18-hour days so that you can make every moment a teachable moment on top of anything you do at work. And if you can't do that, you should quit. You know, the irony is that employed mothers actually spend more time interacting with their kids today than stay-at-home mothers did back in the 60s because we've escalated our demands of parenting so much. So these are two problems facing women. A problem facing men is the masculine mystique that says you still must be the main breadwinner. It's a really unmanly of you to ask for time off with your kids. And furthermore, men are actually face some prejudices of their own now. As women have moved into many male occupations, men who move into female occupations are more stereotyped and actually often sometimes discriminated against. Oh, well, it's only women who can be really good caregivers. So it's a more complicated world than when everything was just based upon telling women they could only do one thing. And we have to rise to that occasion, but it's really important whenever we get discouraged by the challenges facing us, juggling work and family today, to look back to that world when you were not allowed to and both sexes were penalized if they tried to combine them.
Now, see, what you just said, that was great, Stephanie. And what I will want to do sometime in the next couple months is take this last 3 minutes that you've just given us and turn it into a new show.
Well, it's a really needed one because I think this mystique about work and the pressures facing us, which we Americans feel more work-family conflict than any other people in the Western Europe or Scandinavia, and that's because we have such retrograde policies and attitudes.
I completely agree. So we'll pick up there sometime soon.
Great.
We've been talking with Stephanie Kuntz. The book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. And Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you.
On our way out of here today, one of the most brilliant modern minimalist composers, John Cage, died on this day in 1982. So we leave you with his Sonata No. 2 for Prepared Piano. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.